Good evening and welcome to Speak Up Arkansas. Arkansas juvenile justice system is going to be the topic of our conversation this evening. Arkansas actually trails all of the surrounding states and most of the country in their efforts to reduce the number of youth who are incarcerated. Incarcerated means held in a jail, held in a locked, secure residential facility, are held in the in detention. So we are, in fact, going against what is a national trend because all the research shows that actually putting nonviolent, low-risk and moderate-risk kids behind bars, in fact, has a very, very negative consequence. In the studio with me today to talk about the state's juvenile justice system is Tom Massall, who is with Disability Rights, which is the federally designated, enforcer of the rights of people with, particularly children with disabilities. We have Lindsay Miller, who is the Arkansas nonprofit with the Arkansas Nonprofit News Network, which has actually been doing some investigative reporting on the juvenile justice system and the in Arkansas, and Rich Huddleston, who is the executive director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. And Rich, I believe you're also on the Supreme Court's Committee on Children and Youth that is also involved in looking at the juvenile justice system. So I want to remind listeners that this is a live broadcast. You can call anytime at 501-433-0088, or for those shy people who don't want to be on the phone, you can send an email to speakupar@gmail.com. So it's 501-433-0088 or speakupar@gmail.com if you have a comment or question. And I also, if any of you out there have had an experience with the juvenile justice system or a member of your family, if you've ever worked with kids who get into the juvenile justice system or at risk of that, or just have an interest in this topic, we'd love to hear from you. And we'll be here for the next hour. I've got folks again in the studio to talk about an issue that has actually been in the news quite a bit lately. And it's something that I think everybody cares about. And we're glad to have all of you in the studio with us. Rich, can I start with you and introduce, just talk a little bit about Arkansas Advocates and sort of the role they have been playing in the juvenile justice system over the years.
Sure. Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is a nonprofit child advocacy organization. We do a lot of public policy research and advocacy, and I've been around for over 40 years now. I mean, I think our role, led by your host Paul Kelly, actually for the last decade, especially has really been to try and push the state to quit locking up kids, quite frankly, and because I think the research is pretty clear that if you lock up kids, they're just as likely to come out worse off than when they went in. And to really push the state to do more around community-based programs that are about 15% of the cost, roughly, and are a lot more effective, actually, than locking kids up. And so we've been trying to push that from an advocacy perspective for a long time, but especially the last 6 or 7 years.
Okay. Tom, let me ask you this. What is going on in your estimation? What are the critical things that have to be addressed in the system still. I mean, why don't you talk about that a little bit, Rich?
Sure. I think we still have a long way to go in this effort, and I think there are a lot of reasons, some of which I can get into in terms of why Arkansas has really been slow to follow other states in terms of locking fewer kids up and doing more around community-based programs. So I can talk about some of those reasons if you want, Paul, but I think right now there's some work being done by the Arkansas Supreme Court Commission on Children, Youth, and Families in conjunction with the, what's it called, the Juvenile Justice Reform Board. Do I have that right? They're doing some systems work, but I think one thing that's not going to come out of that body is money. Money that's needed for community-based services so we can, in fact, stop locking kids up and give judges other options.
Okay. All right. Tom, explain your organization a little bit, if you'd like. And I know you all have been visiting places, and you're actually, I think, with the exit of Scott Tanner, sort of our who was a juvenile ombudsman. By the way, have they hired a juvenile ombudsman? Does anybody know?
To my knowledge, they haven't.
All right. So that's what, 6-8 months without a
right
juvenile ombudsman? Okay. Right. Well, you're sitting in for him, I guess. But go ahead. Talk.
Certainly.
About that.
Well, it's great to be back again. I'm with Disability Rights Arkansas, and we are a private nonprofit organization. We advocate for individuals with disabilities across the state of Arkansas. Every state and territory has one. And our role in looking at the juvenile justice system here in Arkansas is to ensure that youth who are in the care and custody of the Division of Youth Services are receiving appropriate services, whether that be mental health, whether that be education, and that they're treated fairly and they're free from abuse and neglect. We began looking at the Arkansas juvenile justice system back in 2014. And we went out to the Alexander Center, and we were notified of some serious concerns. We issued a report back in 2014, and then we did a follow-up report. And since that time, we've been expanding our efforts to ensure that the youth across the state are receiving services. And it's been quite an ordeal. Rich mentioned, there's been a lot of time and energy put in by all of the advocacy organizations in ensuring that the youth are safe.
Okay. About what percentage of the youth held in the lockups are likely to have a disability? I know their mental health is certainly, I think the thing that I knew is it was conduct disorder and alcohol and drug abuse combo was sort of what a lot of the kids were diagnosed with. Is that still sort of the case?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. When you look at the number of youth who are receiving special education services or receiving or who have an IEP, individualized education plan, in place, it's a high number. I would guess that it would be about at least 80% who come in. And then there are youth who are committed who are not receiving an appropriate evaluation to determine what services or diagnosis they may have. And any behaviors that escalate while they're in the custody of DYS are deemed as behavioral issues, when in fact they may be due to an individual's mental health diagnosis.
All right. Well, I always like, and how many of them are poor? What role does poverty play in this?
Poverty plays a great role in this. I mean, if you look at the stats and where the kids are coming from, they're coming from broken families. They're coming from just rural parts of the state, and they get involved in all sorts of horrendous things.
Right, right. And rural communities are stressed out too. I mean,
absolutely.
And that's because of the lack of
services
that are there. Okay. I've got other questions, but I want everybody to have a chance. Lindsay, talk a little bit about what you all have done. I've enjoyed reading the articles and really appreciate you all taking a look at this. And kind of what are your thoughts and ideas about this?
Sure. Well, just a little background on who we are. So by day, I'm the editor of the Arkansas Times. But in 2016, I founded the Arkansas Nonprofit News Network as a kind of very big side project, and it's nonprofit, nonpartisan. We really are hoping to fill the gap that has emerged among media everywhere who don't have the resources to do the kind of deep dives into investigative work or public interest journalism. And so we go and get grants and donations and hire reporters and editors to take on complicated stories that matter to Arkansans. And then we distribute for free that reporting throughout the state. We have about 20 partners, some of the bigger newspapers around the state, Jonesboro Sun, Fort Smith Times Record, Arkansas Times, KRK, Fox 16. If anyone's listening who is a media source out there and is interested, give me a holler. Arknews.org is our website. But we've taken on a number of projects this year, and I should say in full disclosure that Arkansas Advocates granted us some money to look into juvenile justice. Additionally, we've done healthcare reporting and government reporting and education. But our juvenile justice-focused work has been on the use of isolation in the juvenile setting. We did a two-part series earlier this year on that, on a particularly egregious case of abuse in the Alexander facility. And then most recently on the unsafe and unsanitary conditions at a couple of Dermot facilities.
Uh-huh. All right. And the have any of the issues been something, Tom, that you guys were aware of in the past? I mean, I know that y'all visited these places too. And what are the... describe Dermot. I mean, I've been there. It's an old building. It's an old place. There's a lot of repairs needed done. And
Tom knows it well, and I don't want to steal his thunder, but I will give one anecdote. And in the reporting I did for this big story on the conditions there, I talked to Senator Eddie Cheatham, who just happened to be touring the facility before the news of the conditions came out. And his comment to me was so there are two facilities. There's the juvenile treatment facility for 13 to 17 year olds, and then with an eyesight there's the juvenile correctional facility for 18 to 21 year olds. And then across the street from that is an Arkansas Department of Correction facility. And Cheatham's response was that the correction facility just looked so much nicer than the juvenile facility, that it was clean and well lit, and that the juvenile facilities just looked dreary and needed some real work. So
right.
The prison is much nicer than the juvenile facilities.
Right.
And these are supposed to be rehabilitative, right, not punitive, unlike a prison.
Right.
Right. And if I can just chime into it, and I think you hit right on the head, is that the prisons are a nicer place than where the youth are. When you have a facility that is falling apart, just being held together by a Band-Aid, dryers not working, leaky faucets, mold in the shower, all those different things, and how do we allow that facility to get that far down the road without really making improvements into it and looking at the lives of the youth who are there, and what's beyond the whole infrastructure piece is what services are not being provided that should be provided for the youth. We've been out there monitoring, and you have youth who are not participating in educational services. They're just 18, and once they get their GED, what's left? What do? They sit around all day, and where do they look? They look out the window and they see the natural progression, which is the correctional facility across the fields. So we really have to do a better job of instilling some hope into the youth and looking at rehabilitation and putting some services in place.
Right. I know education has always been a factor that you all looked at. And the state of Arkansas, a year or so ago, took over the operation of the facilities that were formerly South Arkansas Youth Services and up in Jonesboro. And how are they doing? Are they better than they were before? How are things? Is there improvements going on? Just talk a little bit about that, comparing.
So what we see right now are a lot of gaps. The state went to the virtual Arkansas for all of the treatment centers that where the youth take their classes online. And so you have the youth in front of computers on the internet. And when that was implemented, they forgot to look at security controls. So you had the youth, you know, Facebooking, Zooming with their friends back home. There were no controls, security controls in place. They have one or two teachers in the room with the youth in case there's questions. But what we found is that the adults who were in the room were not really engaged in what the youth were focused on. And so it's just kind of you go at your own pace. There's really no controls. And it might be good for youth who are motivated and really good at that. But what we've seen is that a lot of the youth who are there are not necessarily motivated to do schoolwork without supports. And so they just kind of not do it. So I think the state can do a better job.
So is that the case in all of the residential programs, that it's all, education is all in front of a computer?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. And yeah. That meets the standards that are supposed to be?
There, for those who are receiving special education service at the Alexander Center, they do have teachers in place.
At Alexander?
At Alexander, they have teachers, yeah.
Okay. And what kind of education are the kids getting locked up in detention getting?
None. And they are not receiving any mental health services as well. For those in the juvenile detention centers, out of the 15, only 5 provide some form of mental health services. So if you are sent away to a juvenile detention center that does not provide mental health services, you're not receiving anything.
Yeah, and more, if I can just add to how the state's doing, at least in the Dermot facilities, we found through our reporting, and then Disability Rights also found many of the same things, that for much of 2017, youths at the facility lacked basic hygiene supplies. So we're talking about soap, toothpaste, shampoo, shoes. Kids would have to wear shower shoes in cold weather. The youngest children lacked coats in the coldest months. Many of the dorms didn't have adequate heat or air. It was broken. We talked to former and current staff who said that there were rats in the kitchen that they saw regularly. That was one point that Division of Youth Services really contested and said that health department reports shown clean and there were no rats around. I should say that. But.
Yeah. Well, and how did the Alexander unit do? I mean, that's a far profit for sure. They are doing a better job than the state must do, because I think my sense is the administration is really interested in bringing in more for-profit entities to run this. So how is Alexander doing?
Yeah, from what I understand is the state's plan is to turn all of the treatment centers over to private entities to run, whether that's one single one but the plan is to move them out. Alexander Center is doing, they've gone through some changes as well in terms of leadership and companies coming in, but the Rite of Passage, who currently operates the center out there, they've been doing a better job of bringing in the community. They have a Boys and Girls Club there. They're bringing in Arkansas Rehabilitation Services. That's something that we've been trying to get. So for those who might not know, Arkansas Rehabilitation Services is a state agency designed to assist individuals with looking for jobs and any job types of training that they might need. So we've been long advocating that DYS, Division of Youth Services, reach out to this department and bring those services into the centers. So for those youth who have their GED, that they're getting some sort of job training, that they're not just sitting around waiting, that there's some meaningful activity. So Alexander has been doing a pretty good job of bringing in various state departments and assisting them in those efforts.
Okay. Again, I remind you, this is a live show. If you've have a question or a comment, give us a call here at 501-433-0088, or you can email us at speakupar@gmail.com. Well, how long are kids, how long are the youth spending time more than, how many youth are spending more than 6 months in Alexander? I mean, I think the research says that anything after 6 months, actually things start to deteriorate. So does anybody know how many folks are there?
I don't, but I think for listeners who aren't familiar with the juvenile system might be surprised to know that youths aren't sentenced to time for time like adults are.
Right.
They're sentenced to a treatment plan that DYS determines, and so they could be in, and often are, for real indeterminate lengths. All sorts of things could disrupt the treatment plan. I'm sure that Tom can talk about that.
Yeah, and I think the other piece too is what makes it interesting is that when a youth acts out and they get a disciplinary at the center, they can add time onto it, and so they can keep going. And part of what they have to meet while they're in the facility is their treatment plan. And if the facility is not offering any, sex offender training or anger management, they just kind of sit around and linger and wait for that services to be provided. Or more than that, part of their aftercare plan is, the aftercare plan is put in place right when the youth enters the facility. So when they're done with their treatment, when they go back to their home community, they have a plan in place on what they need to do. If there are some services in that treatment plan that they cannot be provided in their home community, they just kind of sit and wait and they linger. And so there's a lot of youth who just kind of wait because it is part of their treatment plan. They have to meet these plans.
Yeah. Paul, if I could add to that, one of the problems is that, once you got in one of those facilities, there was a plan developed, but far too often on the front end, when youth first come into contact with the system, and no assessment is done on the front end, so we had way too many low and moderate risk kids being sent off to secure confinement, if a front end assessment would have been done, we could have identified a kid as a low risk kid who, quite frankly, didn't need to be going into secure confinement, and probably developed a plan for community based services. And far too often, that wasn't being done until kids were already way into the system. I think there's an effort now. I think there's I think it's been piloted in 3 or 4 counties now, the new assessment system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the plan is to eventually take that statewide. So that should give us better data in terms of, one, who, if at all, really should be going to secure confinement. And, if you send any kids, it really should be limited to the worst of the worst in terms of the highest risk kids, if any at all. What can we do for kids on the front end in terms of services? And so, so hopefully that will help that problem.
Right. Yeah, I think they started out with 3 of them, and then they've moved to 5. It's judicial district, so it may be some multiple counties. But, that was an assessment tool that was done that the Supreme Court helped get implemented. And, that's been going on for several years. Have commitments been going up or down in the last years? Anybody know? Are they still around 500 or so every year to commitments?
I think the commitments have been going down slowly.
Okay.
And I think they've been going down. And is that attributed to the Savory or the assessments that are happening? We don't know, because I think it's still too early to tell.
Right. The Savory is the assessment tool that they use. Yeah.
Yeah.
And commitment means that you are taken out of you're put into the custody of DYS. So that can usually results in residential treatment, either in a locked or a secure, staff secure, or hardware secure facility. So And 500 doesn't sound like a lot, but for this size of this state and our population, that's kind of way off the charts as far as the percentages of kids that we're talking about.
So in 2015, Arkansas confined 175 youths for every 100,000 in the general population, and the national rate was 152.
Yeah.
To give an idea.
Right. It's been a while since I was in the fray, but while it was going on, there was sure a lot of agreement that we were doing a bad job and needed to do something better. What's holding all this up? What's keeping this from? I mean, you mentioned money. Is it money?
Well, I think that's one thing. I mean, I think if you go back 5 or 6 years, you know, there was a lot of initial resistance, even among providers. Probably 5 years ago, they didn't want to see. Even the limited funding that was in the system, you know, they didn't want to see that changed because they wanted to make sure that they were, you know, continuing to receive their allocation. But I think they've come around. I think more probably the last 3 or 4 years. For the longest time, I think you probably had most of the judges who were very leery to give up. I mean, some of their power. I mean, quite frankly, I mean, a lot of communities, you really did not have alternatives for community-based services. And so to close jail beds, in some of these areas, without having community-based services available, that's
right.
That's not good either. But I think, I do think you're seeing that's more the judges come around. I think the leadership at DYS, after Ron Angel retired in, what was it, early 2013, I think. Uh-huh. They went through a number of division directors who, quite frankly, probably shouldn't have been in the job in the first place and did not do well. And so we had a span of probably 4 or 5 years of really unstable leadership at DYS. And I do think that in the last year or two, that's changed with Betty Gooman being there. She's definitely brought some stability to that. You know, but I will say tax cuts is another thing. You know, we've had in the last 3 legislative sessions, we've had $290 million in tax cuts. And once you do that, there's only so much money left for the human service side of the budget. Governor Hutchinson, to his credit, on the child welfare side of the budget for DC, FS, the state's system for children and family services for kids being abused and neglected. Now, he has put some money into that system of the last couple of legislative sessions, but DYS has really not gotten any new money the last couple of, well, for a long time, actually. I think you are starting to hear rumors about the governor does want to make this a bigger priority next time around. He said that publicly, so we'll have to wait and see if that happens.
Uh-huh. I think he said that in 15 and 17, and now we're waiting on 19. Is that is that how it goes? And you think about the adult system. They had a hard time. They did a major change, and then they reneged on that. That's sort of playing out, and it seems like, though, that the youth ought to get a more sympathetic response than the adult system. Talk about education and its role in contributing to the flow of kids into the juvenile justice system and how that's playing out.
So, Paul, before we leave the other issue, I also want to throw out that I think it's a cultural piece here in the state of, we have a high reliance on bricks and mortar and institutions, and we got a tough on crime mentality. And so I think those are also playing into factors of why we can't see any change happening within the juvenile justice system. I am, like Rich said, encouraged that the governor once again said he wants to make this a priority in 2019, but I think it's going to take more than the governor. I think the members of the General Assembly, there's no backing from them. We can't, the concern is that if we close any facilities, it's going to take a huge the local economy is going to take a huge hit. While we shouldn't be balancing the budget or the local economy and the lack of services being provided to the youth. So I think there's a lot of factors in play, but I think the biggest one is cultural here in the state and how we do that. But to your question on education, you know, I think at the front end, it does go back to the schools, because what we're seeing is that especially the students who need special education or need assessments or mental health treatment are not receiving those in schools because for a variety of reasons, whether it be the school doesn't have the resources, they're spending it on other, you know, the football fields and the gyms and all of that. And so the students are being pushed out and being expelled, and there they sit at home with no homebound services, and then they get into trouble, and it kind of escalates from there. So I think we need to do a better job putting mental health services in schools to ensure that kids are receiving an education.
School to prison pipeline.
Yeah. Well, yep. And you see a lot of times, and this is something that we're working on, some reporting around, school resource officers are everywhere these days. It's essentially security guards, and it's common that in these positions, incidents that, you know, when we all were in school would have been handled in the school. Maybe you would have gotten detention, principal would have set you down. Now the school resource officer will, you know, call the local law enforcement and you'll be arrested for a fight or pushing or you know, in one case we've looked at of cursing, you know, you're cursing and that's all of a sudden assault.
Yeah, simple assault was the primary reason for arresting kids in schools. And I think the following that was kind of disruptive, you know, what do you call it when you're, you know, creating a, what I forgot what the legal term is for creating a ruckus and disorderly conduct. That's what it is. And that is a one that's used. So, and again, we're talking about the same population, low income kids who come from challenging circumstances. And it's not always the money. It has a lot to do with family stability, what's going on in kids' lives, just the ups and downs that every day living and getting by. And I think also the lack of things like after school and summer programs, things that get kids positive things to do. I know when I was on the city board, we put in a lot of after school and summer programs and juvenile arrest dropped 75%. But anyway, it's just, there's just, I think back to the money is one of the reasons for that. I do wonder the responses from the Lindsay, and you're kind of talking to people outside of trying to get parents or folks to talk about it, and kind of your assessment of where the public is coming from this. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, most of the response has been that I've heard just anecdotally has been outrage because people aren't as familiar with the system. You know, the few parents that we've talked to have been, you know, more on the engaged end of the scale. I think some of the difficulty, frankly, in reporting on this and finding real people to talk to is that, you know, a lot of these kids are in the foster system or their parents are disengaged and they don't have anyone advocating for them out there. A source in the story for Dermont is a guy named Benjamin Knuckles who lives in Pocahontas, whose 16-year-old son was locked in the juvenile treatment facility. And his son lived in a dorm with no air conditioning. He didn't have shoes, or he had shower shoes only. And then, you know, these are kids, like they're playing and supposed to be active and running around. And so this Benjamin Knuckles called repeatedly to the facility and pestered them to such a degree that finally they let him send some shoes in to his kid and send some toiletry items. But The kid told us that of 32 others that were incarcerated, or not incarcerated, but were sentenced to treatment plans, that there was only one other who was receiving supplies from family. So, you know, it's like so many other hard problems in our state. You mentioned child welfare earlier and the adult system. You know, it can be frustrating when trying to get people fired up about it, because, you know, these are people that a lot of folks just want to forget about and not think about. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that this doesn't get the funding that it should, until there's a big scandal that gets this out in the front of the public. It's just not a priority for the administration. And that's what happened with child welfare.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and there's been plenty of those over the years, over the decades, that are certainly been coverage of that. And it sort of comes and goes and comes and goes. And it they say they're going to do something, but it doesn't happen. But again, callers, I know there's folks out there who've had some experience with youth who are hard to deal with or are with the justice system and might have some thoughts about it or experiences to share. We'd love to hear from you. Ask any questions of the guests you'd like. Give us a call here at 501-433-0088. Or go online at, or just send an email to speakupar@gmail.com. Let's go ahead.
Sorry, Paul. One thing that I'd love to hear, I know you know a little bit about, and I imagine Rich and Tom do. You know, Tom was talking earlier about the culture, among judges and lawmakers, and how, you know, we thought that, they think that locking up is the way to go. But there have been a number of red states that have moved away from locking kids up. How have they done it?
Right. Well, I think a lot of it has to do with leadership from the right places. And that has to do with like a chief justice of a Supreme Court, a governor, someone in the administration, and a really capable director of the state agency that is a well-informed advocate that is willing to stick their necks out. But again, so I think that has been what has brought it around. I think one of the ways that states have successfully gone about doing it is placing restrictions on judges for not being able, prohibiting the incarceration of a nonviolent misdemeanor offender. There is no reason to put a nonviolent misdemeanor offender in a locked facilities. But we've talked about that here over the years. Judges do not want to give up their decision making. They want to make the decisions. And in other states, the Supreme Court has come down, and not the Chief Justice, but several high profile attorneys or people in positions of judicial power have taking up the calls and tried to make that happen. Mm-hmm. But those are some of the things that other states have been able to do. And Rich, you brought this up. Part of the problem is we have been funding the community-based alternatives at the same level for 15 years. And that has even gone up and down. And sometimes it gets a little boost, but the money goes away. And so if we do not provide the services, then the judges are stuck with no choices. Like you said, they don't have them in rural communities. So another way of doing that is making an initial investment up front to expand community-based, proven effective. Because believe me, we know the kinds of services, multi-systemic family therapy, mentoring, after-school and summer programs, all these different kinds of community-based alternatives that may cost $4,500 a kid, but that isn't $45,000 a kid that has to be in a locked facility. But the state has not infused enough money to make that available so that they can provide those alternatives. And when they have made that available, back when in Obama, where he put that special money to states, improvement, whatever it was, to build the economy, they put money into there, and we dropped the commitments to these residential programs. So that's part of the answer to that.
Yeah, if I can just chime in too, I think the other piece is, you know, there are some districts, for example, Judge Braswell, he has reduced his commitments. In Faulkner County. He's reduced his commitments because he has the connections in Faulkner County, and there are services available in the community for that. But if you look at, you know, down in the Delta, there's nothing there. And so I think the only way that we can move past that is to do a true assessment of what services are available in the community across the state, and then begin looking at how do we fund that. I think it's kind of put your money where your mouth is. You know, we've been looking at this issue for the past 20 years, if not longer. We all have plans and recommendations and strategic plans. We continue to have these seven treatment centers that absorb a lot of the money that we're not really doing a good job with. So then let's look at how can we begin building that community investment. One way is to perhaps not have seven, maybe go down to five, maybe go down to four, and reinvest that money back into the community to allow judges the opportunity to move away from these secure confinements and really go down that route. But again, it takes that leadership from the state and the legislature to do that.
Yeah, the counties that are leading right now with using the up-to-date assessment tools and doing community-based treatment, diverting kids away, are the counties that have money. You know, it's Faulkner County, it's Benton County. We've talked to a number of judges who are interested in doing that, but they're like, we don't have any money. Where are we going to send the kids?
Right. I mean, the only reason that Benton and Washington County has had money is because they've had that Casey Foundation-funded JD AI initiative up there. I mean, I can't remember when that came into place, but that was originally funded by the Casey Foundation, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, I don't know.
But they also have community partners who are helping them with that in a way that you might not. And
yeah, Judge Smith up in Bentonville, he really did a great job. He brought in the police department. He brought in probation. He brought in the schools. He brought in all those partners who know and have to work together and understand and buy into a more restorative justice approach to it. Because if you don't deal with it now, we're going to continue to expand our prisons. And it's just a ridiculous waste of human potential of taking away all the opportunities and the lack of hope into so many kids by locking them up. Because even when they're getting education, they're not getting an education that keeps them up to speed. Because they're going to go, once they go back to the community, they're going to have to play catch up. And that's going to be difficult to do. The idea is to do something on the front end to avoid all that. We put a lot of hope into this assessment tool. That can't work in communities
services.
That don't have the options.
Yep. That's right.
Because it not only evaluates whether they should or should not be, it evaluates what services they need. But they see that and they look and they don't have those services, I've got to do this. So I always said it was a three-legged stool. It's the providers of the services, it's the judges, and it's the Division of Youth Services. And those folks all have their kind of dysfunctions that go on. And it must be like national policy. We tried this back in 13, I think, to do a close to home act where we allowed individual judges to take the allocation that DYS gave out and develop a group of folks from their community, like Judge Smith is doing, and say, okay, this is your money of allocation. How do you want to spend it? Because every community is different and everything has a different, and that approach has worked in other states. So there are multiple states that have worked this out. Even Mississippi reduced the incarceration, but don't do it the way Mississippi did, because they just closed down the buildings and they didn't spend any money doing anything else. So the kids just... we don't know what happened to them, but they just did it as a cost savings. They didn't reinvest the money. They spent it somewhere else. So,
Paul, I would add one other factor. You talked about the three-legged school. Of course, I would include Advocates Generally Defined as being part of that. But also parents. Because I think if you look at some of the states that have seen changes,
absolutely.
You have had much more of a grassroots parent. Youth engagement effort, where you've had parents that have really come to the Capitol and really advocated. And at least on juvenile justice, we really have not had that in Arkansas. It's really been much more of a inside baseball type of advocacy strategy, quite frankly.
Yeah, I agree.
If I can just chime in, Lindsay brought this up earlier about the room confinement and isolation. I think that goes back to, as we move forward in reforming the juvenile justice system, we have to have really good policies in place, policies and procedures. We've been advocating for the past 2.5-3 years to develop, have Division of Youth Services develop a room confinement policy or procedures, and we don't have one yet. It's still in draft form. So, I think that we still don't have data. We're lagging behind in all these. We want to look at the data and where have we been from 10 years ago. We didn't collect the data back then. So I think we really need to have some really good internal policies and procedures within the division to begin having these thoughtful discussions and trying to figure out what is the delay? Why is it taking 2.5-3 years to get a policy in place for room confinement or isolation? Why is that?
It's a critical time now, too, because the governor initially said that he wanted to return the 7 facilities back to private contractor control last summer, I believe. Then they said, no, we're going to take a little more time, hire a consultant to review the division and how it works. That just happened not long ago. And then once the consultant does its thing, then they'll put it out to bid. But, what the consultant comes up with, what the response is to that, what the RFP looks like once they do put it out to bid, there's a lot of important things.
Yeah, I think that was a good choice for a consultant, because they've been helping Judge Smith and the other folks do the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, so they're very familiar with Arkansas and they're very pro community-based alternative. So that's a very promising thing, I think.
And I just learned about the consultant today. I know that they've been looking at trying to bring in a consultant and everything. I think it kind of goes back to the piece of, if we're really truly trying to reform the juvenile justice system, then let's reach out to advocates. Let's talk to the parents and find out what are the barriers, what services do they need. My hope is that this consultant will do that. As we go forward, I'm not too hopeful.
Give Tom a call.
Not contacted us? Has he contacted
No,
you?
No, they haven't. And I know it's, we provided them some names.
We've tried to contact them to ask them what they're doing.
So. Right. So, I think it goes back to the whole piece of let's be transparent in what we're doing with the juvenile justice system reforms.
No, but I will say, kind of the one thing on the horizon, I mentioned the lack of state revenue earlier because of what's happened in the last 3 sessions. Well, don't forget, the governor has proposed a $190 million tax cut for high-income earners for the next legislative session. Well, $190 million in tax cuts, I don't know where you get the money unless you just make DYS your only, I mean, you're always the new spending priority. I mean, we'll see if that happens. But
yeah, and the other, and our concern, you know, a concern that's being raised with regards to the privatization of the treatment centers, what is that going to look like? Is it going to be, are the providers going to be, or whoever comes in and takes it over, are they going to have complete control of the running the centers? Or is it going to be they're going to have partial control and the state's still going to provide education, mental health services? So I think those are some things that we need to look at it too as the state goes forward within the RFP. And who has the big stick? So if they're not providing the services, what happens? Is the state willing to pull the contract? And so I think those are some things we need to be looking at.
All right. Let's talk about, let's look ahead, because again, what I've read in the paper is the governor is talking about this issue. It seems to be heading that way. There are some good things going on with the reduction in use of detention by selected. I think there are now Hot Springs and Pine Bluff are doing a juvenile detention alternative initiative. And that is an effort to, when kids come up into the court, to divert them from being placed in detention. Because detention is, you know, like you stated, has fewer services. What else do you think is hopeful? And I understand that the Youth Justice Reform Board has now, it was, I think the legislation said it ended in 18. Those folks are now meeting with the...
It's merged with the Arkansas Supreme Court Commission on Children, Youth, and Families. And so yep. there are how many different subcommittees that are part of that process, five or six different subcommittees,
yeah.
Give or take.
Yeah.
I mean, they're each looking at a different aspect of the system. I don't know when all that work is supposed to be completed, but I would guess sometime this year. But
yeah, we're supposed to report back with some recommendations at our meeting at the end of April, but we have other meetings going on. There's also a legislative subcommittee that's been formed to kind of come up with some proposals based on previous recommendations for the 2019 session. We've been meeting and trying to come up with them. So I think there is hope that in 2019 we will see some positive changes and reforms going forward. I think there is some willingness from the Joint Committee to do something.
All right. And you talked about data. I'm curious to know if how many of the – I would be wanting to know how many of the assessments – showed that the kids were low and moderate risk. In other words, how many of those evaluations indicate that, in fact, the child is really not a proper candidate for being locked behind bars? And then how many times that happens anyway? I mean, is that what other kind of information do you think would be good to have that would be hard hitting to help make the case for moving away from incarceration? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
Well, we know very little about what goes on in juvenile detention centers, which are run by counties or some cities, maybe. We have no data essentially for those, so it's hard to track what's going on with that. That leaves us with a real incomplete picture.
Okay. Right. Well, is the committee at the Supreme Court and the Youth Justice Board have a target for coming up with recommendations? I mean, how many task forces and whatever there's been? Is there a set time frame for coming up with something by the 19th session?
I think you said by the end of April.
Yeah, you know, so I'm sitting here laughing because I'm thinking of a timeline for recommendations. We always have timelines for recommendations. We come up with recommendations and there they sit.
Look at the DYS strategic plan that's on their website and it looks pretty good.
Right.
I mean, it says move away from incarceration and more community care. But
yeah, I mean, at our next meeting in April, we're coming back with some recommendations on this, on these work groups that we formed, looking at timelines of progress for, you know, various things like, at what point should DYS bring on trauma-informed care training for staff? What are some timelines for that? So we're really getting into the nuts and bolts and the weeds of what is it going to look like. But in terms of the bigger picture for recommendations, I don't know.
Right. Well, and you talked about parents. What kind of work can be done to deal with that? And is that part of the effort to get more parents involved? And speaking of parents involved, as anybody wants to give us a call, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 501-433-0088. We're coming to the end of the program, but we'd still like to accept any call with comments or any suggestions for where we should go.
You know, I think Lindsay and Rich touched on it and really highlighted the fact that we need parents to come forward and share their stories, because they are going to be the driving force to create, to reform. We can sit here as advocates and say, oh, this is what we're seeing, but it's the parents who have their children in these facilities that are going to create the positive change. My fear is that we're all going to sit around and talk about these reforms, and something tragic is going to happen to a youth at one of these centers. And then the state's going to be put on the, you know, they'll have to make real quickly make some reforms that, you know, but we've already lost a life of a youth because we've just been talking about it for so long.
Well, we do have elections coming up. So how do we go about getting this topic on the agenda for that? I know, by the way, next week we're going to have the three Democratic candidates for the second congressional district here in the studio.
Well, there are four congressional candidates.
There are four of them? Okay. Well, maybe only three of them could show up anyway. I meant Democrat. I think they were all Democrat, not the Republicans. Maybe that's the next one coming. Is that what you're talking
about? No, there are four Democrats, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I think that is right, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I would just say that the parents just need to start asking these candidates, what are their plans for reforming juvenile justice? You know, and where are they going to put the money for it?
I mean, I would just put a plug in. We have put out a voter's guide on kids' issues, and I mean, juvenile justice is one of those sections. I mean, we've been going around the state doing what I would call like a mini town hall forum, you know, where we try and promote the voter guide and go through a lot of the issues that are outlined in the voter guide, including juvenile justice. And so that's our effort. But I will tell you, it's very limited, you know, because we don't have the staffing to do it night after night, week after week. And so we're probably, you know, doing about seven or eight of those over the next year before the election. But quite frankly, that's just a drop in the bucket of the type of work that needs to be done. So,
and that's at www.aradvocates.org.
Yeah, you can find our voter's guide there. I mean, in the voter's guide, I mean, it has some recommendations on questions that you should ask around juvenile justice, as well as other kids' issues.
Okay. Any other suggestions for some hope? Any kind of people stepping up? I mean, who are the leaders in the judicial community and in the provider community that are, you know, stepping up and are trying to, you know, carry this? I mean, I know you all are all working on it, but
well, I think one heartening sign for those who think that you know, moving away from locking kids up is the way to go is that, you know, there are folks on both sides of the aisle. Supreme Court Justice Rhonda Wood, who, you know, has a nonpartisan office but has been identified you know, as being a Republican, has been a big advocate for it. Judge Braswell is seen as kind of a conservative, has been strong on it.
Representative Meeks, I forget which Meeks brother it is, but
Stephen.
Yeah. But he's on his way out too, so.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a conservative issue in a lot of states because of the silly use of taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. So that the financial argument is really, really strong, and that's persuaded a lot of very conservative states to take that on too. And that group in Texas Mark Levin, his group, really has come to Arkansas and talked about that, but that too kind of fell on deaf ears.
And, and real quickly, there are some providers, there's one, and the name's escaping me, Northwest Arkansas, that is really trying
Daryl
to
Daryl Rhoda?
Yeah, who is really trying to think outside of the box and providing services to people. So I think that's another piece, is providers who are being very creative in how they provide services to keep the youth in the community.
Right. All right. Well, again, you've been listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we'll be back next week. It'll be the environmentalist discussion with candidates for the 2nd Congressional District, and we would love to have you participate. You are listening to KABF 88.3.